Seattle's Morning News. The president is going to move quickly to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And, of course, there's going to be a huge battle because she's considered a leftist. But she wasn't always considered a leftist. Let's go to former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Rob, tell me about her history and how a justice's standing can evolve over time.
Well, her history was that she was a very, very well-known lawyer and then professor of law who really pioneered women's equality in the courts. She was the lawyer for a series of plaintiffs challenging unequal federal laws or the unequal application of federal laws like Social Security. And it probably more than any other part of her legacy, her work to advance women's rights is what we're going to remember. She went to the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in the early 80s, and that's important because it's considered the second most powerful court in the land after the Supreme Court. And she built up quite a record there, over 10 years serving there, I think almost 13 years, and she developed a record as being a moderate. That was her reputation when Bill Clinton decided to nominate her, but she was not his first choice. And she actually had to mount a bit of a campaign behind the scenes for him to finally meet with her. And then he fell hook, line, and sinker, and he nominated her.
So she was considered a moderate when nominated. But so then how'd she get this reputation as being an anchor of the left wing of the court?
Well, first, let's think about what the court was like when she was confirmed in 1993. It was a court that included the first woman on the Supreme Court, Sandra Day O'Connor. Anthony Kennedy came onto the court. David Souter came onto the court. She fit in with this group of moderates. She was often joining those other justices in the center of the court. And so it made sense for her to continue to be a moderate, relatively speaking, because, you know, when you're on the court, you want to be in the majority. You want to find ways to join the majority because you can have more influence on the outcome of the case when you do that. And she did that, you know, quite successfully. Then the court started to change, especially when Sandra Day O'Connor had to leave the court because her husband was ill. John Roberts comes on after that. He's much more conservative. The court starts to move to the right. And as that happened, and as the moderates departed, David Souter retired, Anthony Kennedy, of course, more recently retired. You know, she was left with a group of fellow justices who were probably to the left of her to begin with, and she moved to the left as well. What I'm saying is, it isn't always because you move; it can be because other people on the court are moving, or the people who replace them come in and they're farther to the right. So the center of gravity on the court shifted right, which at a minimum made her look more like she was to the left, more liberal. But I think in addition to that, she consciously staked out a position as the leader of the liberal wing of the Supreme Court.
So in choosing a replacement for her, how do you – I'm sure what President Trump wants to do is choose somebody who at least his constituents believe will remain firmly on the right, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So he's saying he wants to appoint a woman. He's got a long list of potential nominees, including several women. Judge Amy Coney of the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals getting a lot of attention and did before as well. And so is this judge from Miami, Judge Lagoa from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, who, as I recall, was appointed to the 11th Circuit by President Trump. She'd been on the state court before. She's very popular in Florida among conservatives and among Cuban Americans. She is a Cuban American herself. It would be a very helpful move for President Trump politically in the state of Florida if he were to appoint her. However, unlike Amy Coney, Judge Lagoa has only been on the 11th Circuit for a relatively short period of time. And the conservatives, and including people in the Federalist Society, which vets a lot of these candidates, they're not 100% sure that she's a so-called reliable conservative. They're more certain of that, I think, with Judge Coney on the Seventh Circuit. So it'll be very interesting to see what President Trump decides to do, because he wants to pick someone who conservatives, you know, almost uniformly are enthusiastic about. But at the same time, he's, I'm sure, tempted by the idea of helping himself in the very important state of Florida with all those electoral votes that, you know, that state will contribute.
He wants somebody who will join in overturning Roe v. Wade, right?
I don't know what Trump really believes about that. You know, he you know, clearly cut a deal with people who would like to overturn Roe v. Wade. That's been their aim for a long time. And, you know, the risk of it happening would be greater with a 6-3 conservative majority because Chief Justice Roberts could no longer stop that from happening. And I think he would vote to not overturn Roe v. Wade if it were a 5-4 conservative majority. I think he would be very concerned about the harm to the Supreme Court as an institution. So Trump might be thinking about that. But let's be clear. By the time that case comes along, that vote's taken, this election will be long over.
Yeah.
So my guess is that if Trump thinks it's more helpful to him politically to pick Judge Lagoa from Miami than Judge Coney from the upper Midwest, he's going to go with Judge Lagoa.
Yeah. But both of them are conservative. Both of them would likely overturn Roe v. Wade, right?
I'm not sure. I don't know enough about Lagoa's history on that issue. She's only been on the Federal Court of Appeals a short time. It seems more likely with Judge Coney. You know, the interesting thing is, just as an aside, Justice Ginsburg was viewed with some skepticism by people on the left when she was nominated for the Supreme Court because she had written that she thought Roe v. Wade, while not wrongly decided, could have been decided on narrower grounds. And some feminists were not happy with her about that. Obviously, she was always a champion of women's right to choose, and there was never any risk that she would vote to overturn Roe v. Wade. But there can be shades of opinion on that issue. And I have to say, overturning Roe v. Wade and saying, oh, well, after all these years, it was just wrong, that's a pretty big reach for any court to make.
Even for a 6-3 conservative court?
Well, you could see a 5-4 majority, I suppose. I think Justice Thomas would vote to overturn it. Justice Alito would vote to overturn it. Perhaps Kavanaugh and Gorsuch as well. But at the same time, you know, like Chief Justice Roberts, they're going to be somewhat concerned about the impact on the court itself. They're going to worry that it will be such an incendiary move this many years, what, 5 decades after Roe v. Wade was decided, that it could result in a move in Congress to pack the court, expand the number of justices. That assumes, of course, you have a Democratic president and Democratic control of the Senate. But there are Democrats now talking about that very move.
Yes.
Should this court go 6-3, I think the mere fact of it going 6-3 conservative to liberal would not be enough. But if they overturn Roe v. Wade and the Democrats controlled the White House and Congress, it could happen.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, Dave.
6:22 Seattle's Morning News. Before I get to traffic, I just want to acknowledge that some news outlets are saying here the CDC has acknowledged COVID-19 mainly spreads through the air, as if this was a big change. So I just went to the CDC website this morning, and it looks pretty much like the same thing we've seen. It spreads through respiratory droplets or small particles such as those in aerosols produced when an infected person coughs, sneezes, sings, talks, or breathes. It also points out that sometimes it can travel distances beyond 6 feet, for example, during choir practice in restaurants or in fitness classes. In general, indoor environments without good ventilation increase this risk. This sounds to me like the same advice we've heard before, but just in case there's any doubt, the official CDC website is saying that 6 feet at the very least, and if somebody is doing something like singing at you or, I assume, shouting at you, then beyond 6 feet, and of course, wear the mask. This is Seattle's Morning News. We're all looking forward to turning the corner and getting back to normal after conquering this epidemic. But what if getting back to normal means we still need to wear masks? Let's call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Gordon, you sent me this article about all the other nasty viruses out there. And the first thing I said was, yikes, we're going to have to wear a mask even when the COVID thing is over.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an interesting discussion because the flu season is upon us, right? People are starting to get their flu shots. Actually just got mine a week ago, and usually the symptoms of the flu start around October and can run through February or even as late as May. And we still have COVID going on. So it's a problem because we could potentially end up with two epidemics occurring at exactly the same time, both the flu and COVID-19. it's going to be very difficult to distinguish between the two at any given time in any given person. Really, in many ways, the only way you're going to be able to discriminate between the two is based on testing.
So given the similarity of symptoms, then, does that mean that everybody who goes in with flu-like symptoms is probably going to have to get a COVID test?
Look, let's think about what happened actually when COVID first came out. So there was no good testing last February, right? What happened was, is there was actually an algorithm that was created. If you showed up into the doctor's office or in urgent care in an emergency room, the algorithm was you would test somebody for flu. And if they tested negative for flu, but they had severe symptoms, then you would test them for COVID-19. However, if they tested positive for flu, then you wouldn't do any coronavirus or COVID testing. Now, as it turns out, as early as March, there started to be reports of people who were co-infected, not a lot of reports, but who were co-infected with both the flu and COVID-19. Being co-infected isn't really that uncommon. Actually, if you test people, even now there's a study that was done, I think, at a University of Washington, where they tested people for COVID-19 and they were also testing them for other viruses. And it turns out about 20% of people had some other respiratory virus present that they cultured positive for. So the virologists and epidemiologists are all worried about the possibility of having these two major epidemics at the same time. And the reason I'm saying epidemic versus pandemic, because pandemic means that it's happening globally. And we're really talking about what happens in the United States or even our own communities, and that would be an epidemic. And so we could have two epidemics occurring in parallel, and they could either both happen and have the problem with people being co-infected and getting very, very sick, or it could be that we actually see a reduction in the number of people who get the flu this year because of all the hygiene practices that we've taken and put into place in order to reduce the likelihood of getting infected with coronavirus and getting the COVID-19 infection. So, you know, wearing a mask will definitely help to reduce the number of people who get the flu, because frankly, coronavirus and the flu virus are transmitted the same way, by either contact or the droplet method. And so masks prevent against that. Also, the good hand hygiene, not shaking hands, doing elbow bumps, sneezing or coughing into your elbow, those things will also help to reduce the incidence of getting the flu. So one of the possible scenarios is that we actually see less people who get the flu this year, and that the overall mortality from people who get the flu and the number of people who die from coronavirus, it could be that the combined of the two is actually reduced because we actually have less flu infections and actually less flu deaths.
So then bottom line, even after we finally get the coronavirus vaccine, do you think it'd be a good idea for people who've now, a lot of us got in the habit of wearing the masks, to just keep doing it?
I mean, I would prefer that we don't have that. It may be that we need to do that, but I'm hopeful that that's not the case. But one of the things that's going to be important is that people actually get the vaccine. So, you know, only about 40% of people get the flu vaccine every year. If we only have 40% of people also getting the coronavirus vaccine, well, we're going to still have a problem. And in that case, everybody's going to need to be wearing a mask. I think there are certain groups of people that it should have always probably been the case, right? People who are food servers, food handlers, who are bringing us our food. Those people should probably always be wearing masks. I think for us as healthcare workers, we probably should be wearing masks all the time because we're dealing with vulnerable people. And I think probably during the flu season, although this is, I don't know that this has ever really been discussed, but, you know, should teachers be wearing masks when they're around young school children, because school children are vulnerable to the flu?
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, as you probably know, a lot of people are unhappy with the way the Seattle Police Department handled the summer demonstrations. You had one incident involving a child shot with pepper spray, an officer with his knee on the neck of a protester. There were thousands of complaints against the Seattle Police Department filed with the Office of Police Accountability. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott has the results of the first few of those investigations. Here's her report.
Since protests on May 30th, the Office of Police Accountability has received nearly 20,000 complaints against SPD and its officers that have resulted in OPA opening 118 investigations and counting. On Friday, the results of the first five cases were released, and it was a bit of a mixed bag. More than 10,000 of the OPA complaints were connected to a little boy hit with pepper spray during a single incident on May 30th during a protest that saw widespread looting downtown and was eventually declared a riot. A video of the boy crying went viral, with most claiming a specific officer intentionally sprayed the boy. But OPA Director Andrew Meyerberg says their investigation, which included looking at body-worn camera footage of around a dozen officers and a ton of video on social media, not only showed that that officer was not the one to deploy the pepper spray, but also that there was much more to this story.
What happens is that officers start to push back, and a female protester who's wearing a white shirt begins to push through the line. And she grabs a baton of one of the officers and starts to push into that officer while holding the baton. At that point, the sergeant, he steps up to the line, says, "Move back, move back." She pushes through, and he pepper sprays her with a burst of pepper spray that appears to be in the head area. At that time, she kind of ducks and turns, and it looks like some of the pepper spray bounces off of her head. And they didn't know this at the time, but immediately behind her is the father. What we were able to figure out by looking at other video and other angles is that the father had moved from about 15 feet away towards the disturbance with his son and was positioned directly behind the protester when she pushed through at the time she was pepper sprayed. So it looks like some of it spilled over her and affected the father and then the child.
And that was within department policy, so OPA did not sustain that complaint. Another high-profile case that same day involved an officer restraining a man by putting his knee on his neck in video that again went viral.
When we reviewed that Twitter video, I think what was pretty clear to OPA was that at for around 13 seconds, the officer's knee was what we believe was on the neck of the person on the ground.
When OPA interviewed
the officer said basically that he didn't believe that his knee was there and that his purpose was to put the knee across the back of the neck towards the back. So, from reviewing the video, we didn't see any indication that he intended to restrict the individual's breathing or that he meant to use a carotid restraint with his knee. But from our perspective, we found that it violated the use of force policy.
So that led to a partially sustained finding. Plus, the officer was dinged for making some unprofessional comments. The findings are now in front of the chief of police, who will decide on any discipline. The three other cases are less high profile. One where an officer used profanity when making comments about using force was sustained, and that cop will also be disciplined by the chief. Another involving allegations of excessive force when officers pushed protesters out of the way of a charter bus during a June demonstration was not sustained, essentially because it was for their own safety to ensure the bus could pass. The case also involved claims from a protester who said they were targeted because of their sexual orientation, but OPA found no evidence of that. The last one involved claims of an elderly man being pushed down by officers, and in that one, OPA could not find evidence one way or the other.
I mean, for us, that's the most unsatisfactory conclusion, is an inconclusive, because basically it means that we just can't tell one way or the other. But there are times with these protests that, unfortunately, we're looking almost for a needle in a haystack, right? Like someone is saying, "I was struck by a blast ball at, 13th and Pike," and we try to go through the video, and if we don't have descriptors, it's literally impossible for us to identify who did it and when it occurred.
Almost immediately after these results were made public, those involved in demonstrations took to social media and were highly critical of OPA and its findings on social media. But Meyerberg says it's important to remember,
what you're dealing with is a situation that's incredibly chaotic, high emotions on all sides, that happens in a span of seconds. Most of these situations are not particularly easy to discern, right? Because the officers may be thinking one thing, the protester may be thinking another, and both sides in some cases may be totally valid in what they're thinking. There's other cases that we're going to find like that there are violations of policy. Like there are things, and this is not a secret, right? There are things that went wrong at these protests, and officers are going to be held accountable for the things that went wrong. However, these were very, very chaotic situations, and it's not just SPD, right? Our departments across the country struggled with these protests and struggled with the correct tactics to use.
And Meyerberg says it's important to realize not everything you see on social media is painting the accurate picture, regardless of where it's coming from.
What I really, really, really stress is that if you're going to disagree with OPA's findings, that's fine, right? But please base that disagreement on a full evaluation of the evidence. I do think sometimes that, people will post a 20-second video online, or we'll post a portion of the video, or we'll post, video that on both sides, right? And police departments do this too. You post the part of the video that makes you look the best.
right? What I would say to people is that our job is to go through all the video, right? And it's to realize that, again, there are protesters that are causing damage for which there is probable cause to arrest them, and ones that are causing a threat of harm for which force is probably reasonable, necessary, and proportional. There are also officers that have used excessive force and engaged in unprofessional actions. So our job is to hold those officers accountable, but where it didn't go wrong is to call that out too, right? Is to put that in our case summary.
He believes SPD is still well ahead of other departments when it comes to policing, but that doesn't mean there's not more work to be done.
Clear about to everyone is that OPA itself cannot fix this problem, right? Like, there needs to be changes to approach, to policies, to how these protests are handled. Should you send officers out to protest when the protests are about the police? Should they stay back? You know, what do you do about property damage? Should you be using less lethal tools for property damage? Should you not be? There's all these questions that have to be answered. And I think our investigations will play into those questions, because at the end of the day, we have to fix this, right? What's happening now is not working, and how do we fix it, and how do we make it so SPD's response to these protests is understood and deemed as legitimate?
And Hannah joins us live. Hannah, what's his name again?
Andrew Meyerberg. He's the director of the Office of Police Accountability for Seattle.
He sounds like a very reasonable man to me. Does he have community support? I mean, he's doing something that really almost no one has an interest in doing, and that is trying to objectively figure out what exactly happened and cut through the biases that each side tries to create.
He has some community support. It helps some. I think there is, he said to me that he has a level of distrust from certain people in the community. You know, a lot of those kind of leading the protests, they don't believe his findings. They think he's, you know, in the pocket of the mayor or, you know, part of, you know, in line with SPD. But this department that was created under the consent decree, and he and his team spend an enormous amount of time going through all of this, and his work is really important. He does do exactly what you're saying, try to cut through all of the bias. So there's enough support that I think it's definitely helpful, and OPA is a big part of what we're doing moving forward with the consent decree and anything else with the city of Seattle.
And are there demonstrators being actively prosecuted now for their conduct during the demonstrations?
Yes, there's a handful of folks who've been busted for assault or a couple of looting prosecutions mm-hmm. going on. I believe mostly with the King County Prosecutor's Office, not so much in the city of Seattle Municipal Court. But then there's also some federal charges against, again, the one individual who was involved in the fire and the cement being put on the door of the East Precinct.
All right,
and then the other person who was arrested on federal arson charges for the Molotov cocktails torching the SPD vehicles back on that May 30th protest. So you've got federal and local charges against maybe 10 to a dozen, I think, actively.
Hannah Scott, thank you, Hannah.
Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. At a secondhand store in Baltimore, there's an unusual chair that's drawing a lot of comments lately. It looks a bit like something you'd find in Disney's The Little Mermaid. The back of the chair is made of pastel purple fish. The seat looks like a blue and yellow striped pincushion. CBS's Steve Hartman tells the story of how it brought a group of strangers together for an act of kindness.
A couple weeks ago, someone posted a picture of this bizarre chair on a Facebook page called Weird Secondhand Finds That Just Need to Be Shared. And when Syracuse auto mechanic Emily Del Favaro saw that chair, she about had a cow because of what's on her calf. And here's the truly amazing part. Emily never owned the chair. She just saw it once, years ago, and felt strangely compelled to have it tattooed.
That's the fate about it. I saw that chair and it was everything for me.
You make it seem almost mystical.
I believe that it is.
Almost like you have to get the tattoo and you don't know why.
Exactly.
But answers were coming. After she posted a picture of her tattoo on that Facebook page,
I was like, oh my God.
Hundreds of women in the group felt a call to action.
It belonged to her.
You felt like Emily had to have this chair.
A chair like that and a tattoo that matches, it's kismet. Like, it's serendipity. It just has to happen.
So, even though none of these women had ever met, they started a GoFundMe. Raised $600 to buy the chair for this total stranger, and then devised a plan to personally deliver it.
Perfect fit.
First, Jen Gerard picked it up in Baltimore, drove it to Meredith, who drove it to Marianne, and so on, up Interstate 81, more than 300 miles. Sarah Edwards carried the precious cargo on its last leg.
It is very similar to driving my children home from the hospital the first day they were born. Nervousness, excitement.
I can't even comprehend why anybody would want to do something like this for me.
It's a legitimate question.
And it very quickly was not about a chair anymore.
It gave me something that I needed and I didn't know I needed.
I think a lot of people are looking for ways to connect and looking for any excuse to connect. And if it's a fish chair, it's a fish chair.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Sorry.
Clearly, kindness can take many forms.
I mean, we're a fellowship. We're a fellowship of the fish chair.
But the best kind of kindness is always that random act.
Oh, my God.
That somehow makes people believe again.
I did not need the chair, but I did need to be reminded that kindness lurks in even the weirdest little places.
All we need to do is fish for it.
I'm going to tell you, Dave, that that fish chair is rather unique. We're going to post a picture of it on our Cairo News Desk Twitter page.
Yeah, there
page.
It is. Check it I was out. Just
yeah.
Googling it.
Yeah, it's funky looking.
It actually is not completely unattractive.
No, I like it.
I mean, yeah, I can see why you want that tattoo.
Yeah.
On your calf.
Yeah.
Now, from the G. Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, here's G. Scott, who is at the game. And so, do they pump the crowd noise into the stadium?
Yeah. There's a little bit of crowd noise. Yeah.
Did it do it for you?
No, it's really low. And as a matter of fact, starting, they'll finish out the Monday night game. The Raiders have the game, and starting next week, it's going to be louder inside of the stadium because it's too low. It's awkward.
Now, like 70 decibels, right, Gene?
For the I don't even know.
Yeah, that's why it's a memo issued by the NFL.
There is no thermometer when you walk into the stadium. Yo, what the decibels set
the decibels?
At?
7.
So, but as far as the TV, right? The TV for you guys is viewing pleasure. It's kind of somewhat normal. Now, yeah. Inside of the stadium, I mean, completely not normal. Like, for an example, when that interception happened, the pick six that Greg Olsen dropped went through his hands, and they returned it for a touchdown. It was eerie, right? Like, it's like he scored a touchdown, and they were kind of cheering, and you could like hear them cheering. So for me, it was the first time I've been at an NFL game where I can like hear, but yo, I can really hear what all of them are saying right
yeah.
now. So it's just kind of awkward and weird. Now, here's where during the game I was tweeting, and I was there because I had to work. I had to do a deal for the Seahawks with Microsoft Teams and everything. But during the game, I was there, and I'm watching Russell Wilson. Now, Russell has been here since 2012. Russell is a good quarterback, right? He's a really good quarterback. Russell is so good right now. I'm trying to really, guys, take you into the stadium. Russell is so good right now that I actually think that no crowd in the stands is a benefit to him.
Yeah.
It would be like the difference between some of those like, hey, I like for it to be quiet. I like to concentrate and study or have to get ready for a test or something like that. That's how he was. He was so laser focused. I have never seen that man play the way that he plays. I knew that they were going to win the game. Now, I didn't know it was going to be that close, but I knew he was going to be so good based on like the first couple times possessions of the Seahawks got, and here's why. Because usually when I'm watching, the game is so fast. These are professional athletes. Everybody, pum, 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 running all over the place. But when Russell gets it, the game slows down dramatically. And you can just, it felt like I was playing a video game and like watching what he was watching. And the dude is just so, he's like a magician with the ball out there. It was a beautiful thing to see. But both
so
on TV or in the stands, doesn't
matter.
Are you saying
that the influence of the 12s is overrated?
No, I am not. I'm saying that when Russell is on offense, no fans in the stands are probably better. But when the Seahawks are on defense, oh, yeah. My goodness, are the 12s missed. dramatically so. They are missed. You're talking about there was a couple third downs where Cam and the Patriots had the ball, and I'm like, yo, if the fans are here right now, they'd be losing their minds. And it was just quiet. It was quiet. You could hear church mouse talking to each other. It was crazy.
Hey, G, on that last play of the game, from the 1 yard line, of all things, of course, Patriots, Seahawks, 1 yard line again. What do you make of the play call? Should the Patriots have passed the ball instead of run it?
I don't like the question, AG.
Okay. All right.
You know, I think, hey, okay.
I'm just saying.
Let me tell you. The question you asked me hurts.
Okay.
And what the broadcast did, like I need to write a letter. You know how folks always say, I'm going to write a letter. I'm going to write a letter to the folks that why during that play would they really replay the slant at the goal line of the Super Bowl? So, no, the best play for the Patriots to use would be Cam getting the ball and running it. And I know everybody's going to be talking about L.J. Collier. He's the one who kind of, he made the big tackle on him. But I want to give a shout-out to Delano Hill. Delano Hill, he was the safety that was up on the line. He was the last guy on the line. And he goes in and he spills and he takes that fullback out to kind of really stop the play in his tracks where he didn't get any forward momentum. And that was the reason why Cam wasn't able to get there. And, of course, Bobby Wagner, from what I'm hearing, is the one that called for the defensive slant. So he's the mastermind at kind of organizing where the defense was supposed to slant to. It was just a beautiful game.
I mean, he did a full somersault, Cam did.
He sure did.
That is amazing.
I mean, what a beautiful way for the game to win. But once again, the Seahawks are a winning team. They're 2-0, and it's just kind of great. The Seahawks, since Pete Carroll has been here, all they've done is win.
G. Scott joins Ursula at 9 o'clock here on Car Radio. Thanks, G. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Aaron Granillo and Chris Sullivan. And now joining us is CBS News Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, your blog over the weekend got me looking at the national debt clock. I'm sure you're familiar with that. And I'm seeing the annual deficit, federal deficit year over year, is $3.1 trillion, that for every dollar that we pay in taxes, the federal government spends two, and that the national debt is now $26.7 trillion. If you piled that money in a single stack, you'd be wasting your time because nobody cares. What's the deal?
I like how you put it into stark relief. You know, I thought it was interesting because I went back into the time capsule, the way, way back capsule, and I was looking at how much everyone used to talk about the debt and the deficit, and it's almost vanished right now. Of course, amid a pandemic, you would expect that. There's really not a lot to do when the economy essentially stops dead in its tracks. Tax receipts go down because millions of people are unemployed. Businesses are not making as much money because they're not actually seeing the people come in and they are paying less in taxes. And at the same time, the government essentially has to go out and spend a bunch of money to help the economy survive. So an annual deficit, meaning the difference between what comes in and what goes out, that's not surprising. What is surprising to me is that there is absolutely no conversation about the fact that the national debt, those deficits added up year after year, that national debt is essentially going to become larger than the entire United States economy. Yeah. And that's so strange because I think you and I both grew up in a time where that would have been front and center of a campaign, and now it's just gone from conversation.
Well, because the inflation rate is so low. It's what, 2% maybe?
Yeah, I think, and remember, the Fed said we really want more inflation, and you're absolutely right. It's that there are two things that are happening right now. We're carrying these big debt levels amid plunging interest rates. So really, the weakness in the economy is such that it's very cheap to finance all of the debt that we're carrying, and inflation remains incredibly low. I guess the big question is, if inflation were to rear its ugly head, if interest rates started to rise, if all of a sudden that investors said, you know what, we don't want to lend to businesses, the Dave and Jill business, we want to just lend to the federal government because we're getting paid more interest rates, we're getting higher interest there, and it's really hard to borrow money if you're anyone but the government, and we start to see inflation, will we have a response by the government that would be higher interest rates, fighting it off, maybe even thinking about raising taxes or cutting programs? That's when the real scary scenarios start to pop into our minds.
Well, we're smart. Let's think this through. What is it that drives inflation? I mean, back in the day, it would be driven by powerful unions threatening strikes and forcing huge wage increases. And we have nothing like that now. I mean, workers are pretty much powerless to get raises, at least, you know, middle-class workers. At the top, you get raises, but not middle-class workers. And there seems to be no rush to change that. So as long as most workers remain powerless to increase their pay, inflation should remain under control, right?
Right. And there's also an aspect of this, which is when you're in a global recession, that the competition to get a job is so vast that you can't even see that without a labor union, sometimes just the market will drive wages higher, right? We saw that. You know, Amazon didn't go to $15 an hour because they're out of the kindness of their hearts. They did because there was this idea like, we can't get people. And you start to see competition for people to come on board. We're not seeing that. And I think that what's really going to be interesting around this conversation is something called modern monetary theory, MMT. And MMT is a theory that's been espoused by a number of economists. The one that I'm most familiar with is a woman named Stephanie Kelton, and she's just written a book about modern monetary theory. And her thesis is essentially that deficits and debt is not a problem as long as there is full employment and until we see inflation. And if we do see inflation, then we see higher rates, and that would be the response by the government. And it may be true, and we may be living this experiment right now, frankly. The question really becomes, if we do see that inflation, if interest rates were to rise, do we have a system in place that could manage that? Or would the government just go back to the old playbook and say, cut some programs or raise taxes or do some of both?
Yeah. Searching my memory, the last time we had a big inflation shock was during the Carter years and the Arab oil embargo, right?
Right. That would be called, and when you say what creates inflation, sometimes we have an exogenous event, like something outside of us that creates that inflation.
But that's not going to happen anymore because we're awash in oil now, aren't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really interesting to consider whether the fear of inflation is something that's sort of way in like the way back time capsule. And of course, as soon as I say that, that's when we're going to get some bout of inflation.
Right.
So I never want to say that, you know, this time is different, but we've just never seen the government carry this level of debt in this kind of environment before. And we don't know how it's going to work out. But I do know one thing. It's not going to be resolved anytime soon.
CBS Senior Business Analyst Jill Schlesinger. Thank you, Jill.
Take care.
836 Seattle's Morning News. It's a service that helps first responders when they're the ones in crisis. Here's Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch to introduce us to Cairo's Charity of the Month, Code 4 Northwest.
They're the people who answer when you call for help.
Anytime somebody has some type of trauma happening, they call 911, and it's our first responders who are there on scene. So they become shareholders in society's grief, and they're immersed in society's trauma. And it takes an emotional toll on their lives.
Pat Ellis has been a crisis intervention coordinator and chaplain in Western Washington for 20 years. He says this year has been particularly rough on first responders who are dealing with what he calls COVID fatigue.
Tonight, there's new concern among experts that testing for the coronavirus may fall off after the CDC suddenly changed its guidelines.
Our first responders are inundated with policy change and with operational change and how we have to deal with 911 calls to keep our first responders safe from pandemic type issues. So it gets tiring after a while.
Keep it tight!
Keep it tight!
First responders are also on the front lines of social unrest, where some police reform protests have turned from insulting to violent.
Get the blast balls up here!
You have taken an oath to serve your community and keep them safe And then to have members of your community turn on you. Very, very stressful and very disheartening.
So where do the people we call for help turn to when they need help?
Code 4 Northwest is a crisis hotline for people in emergency services.
Ellis coordinates a team of current and former first responders based in Washington State who answer calls from colleagues dealing with job stress that can manifest in different ways.
The addiction issues, the relationship issues, the stress-related issues with post-traumatic stress disorder, secondary traumatic stress, things like that.
The I get it part of this seems so important.
It's critical. It's absolutely probably one of the most critical pieces to be able to call somebody who gets it, who understands it, and has said, you know what, I've been in that same place, and here's how I was able to work through that situation. It makes all the difference in the world.
They provide an understanding ear and can connect callers to resources in their own community for additional help.
And we can help them keep their jobs and keep their families.
How does he know it works? He says many of the volunteers answering calls were helped by Code 4 Northwest themselves.
For them to come back and say, you know, I've walked this road and I know that my fellow first responders are on this path as well. I want to help. And it's heartwarming to hear that story.
And he says this charity is needed more than ever. They've seen a 25% increase in calls because of the pandemic and social unrest.
Cairo Radio's Heather Bosch. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.